I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to explore the legacy and impact of one of America's great novels, Slaughterhouse-Five by Indiana's own Kurt Vonnegut. We're going to explore why this was the breakthrough novel for him and why, in this, the 50th year of its publication, it has continued to define his work and his reputation. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a special No Limits today, and I should say it's good to be back live here in the studio. We are going to be talking about one of my favorite books, one of the most important books in American literature, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, which was first published 50 years ago this spring. If you want to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Well, I've got in the studio with me right now Julia Whitehead, who is pretty much everything at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. Julia, welcome back to the program. I know, is this like fourth or fifth time you've done the show?
I'm fortunate that you keep asking me back, John.
Well, it's always good to have you in the studio. So I know this is a big event. This milestone is a big one that the Museum and Library are celebrating in some special ways. Could we start the conversation before we get into the more general one of talking about the book, about what is going on, what you've got going on to mark this occasion?
Yeah, there are so many great things. My very favorite thing, I think, is the 86,000 book giveaway, which is quite a bold undertaking. We are giving each Indiana high school sophomore a copy of Slaughterhouse-Five. And we've already gone to some schools. We have schools on our list even out into the fall. But our goal is to give away 86,000 copies of this book. And people are donating the money for this book. We're working with Penguin Random House. And they've donated copies, too. So that's a big thing. Also, this is very, very important. As you know, we don't have a location open right now. Mm-hmm. We are... our lease ended, and so we are trying to buy a building, 543 Indiana Avenue, and we have until May 15th to raise $1 million as part of a larger goal. But getting to $1 million by May 15th will be a big step forward for us to acquire this building, which will house a permanent Slaughterhouse-Five exhibition that will open on Vonnegut's birthday in November. And then we have, Vonnegut Fest, November, this unveiling of this very special exhibition, Banned Books Week, September, which will have themes related to Slaughterhouse-Five. We do a summer teacher training workshop that'll have that book as its focus as well. And just, lots of other things we're doing in the meantime.
And quick question, how did you decide on sophomores?
We had conducted a pilot program with eighth grade students at a middle school, and we discovered that for us and the teachers we worked with, while that book is perfectly fine for some students, not all students were quite there with the some of the things that are discussed in that book. So we thought that high school was more appropriate to make this, major effort. Also, we didn't want to wait until students were seniors. We wanted to get them early enough to where if their teachers want to, bring Vonnegut into the classroom, you know, his books, then we want to definitely promote that reading of Vonnegut early on.
So let's go back to let's talk a bit more about the event on April 11th.
Thank you, because I didn't even mention that. And that is such a huge thing for us. It is our annual gala, our Night of Vonnegut. We have been doing this since even before we had a building. We were holding a Night of Vonnegut. And so that is next Thursday, April 11th. It is at the Athenaeum Theater. A few tickets are still available at vonnegutlibrary.org. And we are featuring the historian Douglas Sprinkley, as well as our keynote speaker, Salman Rushdie. So we're thrilled to have both of them joining us. And we have a number of awards we're giving away, and it's just going to be a wonderful night for us.
And what is the ticket price?
It's $150 per ticket, and there are discounted tickets for students as well. And we will be using these funds to help us with our building and with our programs this year. And you want to come on out. There's going to be wonderful food, and it should be a great time.
And if people want to purchase the tickets, where do they go?
They can go to vonnegutlibrary.org on the homepage. That will take you to the ticket link.
Okay. So let's talk about the book itself. I think one of the central questions is why that book, because it is a sort of before and after marker in Kurt's, and I should disclose here that Kurt Vonnegut and I were friends during the last years of his life and talked about his work, but that book marked a kind of a before and after period in his career. Up until then, he was a really, really well-respected author, but he did not sell a ton of books. Slaughterhouse-Five changed that. Just about everything he wrote after that landed on the bestseller lists. What was it about that book you think that exploded in the way that it did?
The timing of that book, that was accidental, because he was trying to write the book earlier. He tried to write it for 20 years. But the timing during the Vietnam War, and at a time when a number of World War II veterans were not being open and honest about, what happened to them, what they did during the war, kind of just wanted to forget about the negative experiences. Vonnegut, there he was with Slaughterhouse-Five, very openly describing horrific war scenes while throwing in science fiction, humor, sex, and, all of these things that made this book so unique and special. I do think the timing of it was perfect to send the message he wanted to send to the world about war and about the need to avoid war.
When did you discover the book for the first time? I mean, that's always fascinating what your reaction was when you read it.
Yeah, so that's a good question. This story, there are a couple different stories about how I found Slaughterhouse-Five. When it really impacted me was in my later years. I had a high school teacher who had introduced it to me, but I didn't get it so much then. But then in my 30s, I read Slaughterhouse, and that was after I served in the military. Mm-hmm. Completely different experience at that point, and I really connected with the book and then went on to read other Vonnegut's works.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Slaughterhouse-Five, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary. It was published on March 31st, 1969, for the first time. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. I think one of the things that has impressed me, I know you said that the book didn't speak to you when you were young, But one of the things that dazzles me about Kurt and his ability to connect with an audience is that I have a lot of young people, you know, when they find out I knew Kurt and that I knew Kurt Vonnegut, come up and they will ask, you know, what was he like? And, you know, it becomes clear they can quote chapter and verse from his books. They've not just read them, but have read and reread and memorized. And, you know, in a way that the only other writer I get anything, not that I knew this, I know this person, but, you know, for a while there with particularly young women between the ages of 11 and 17, the Harry Potter books seem to evoke the same kind of devotion.
I sometimes quote them myself.
Yes. But what was it about Kurt? Because for many of these kids, I mean, he's not just their parents' age or even their grandparents' age. He'd be their great-grandparents' age right now. What is it about him that speaks to them so powerfully, you think?
I think there are multiple things. One is that he, you know, he always includes himself in his, or often included himself in his work, even if it is just in the introduction. And, you know, he opens himself up and he is courageous in his feelings and his words and the things he is willing to share with his audience. And I agree. I mean, we have, you know, some of the students who are, you know, receiving these books are thanking us and they love his storytelling and his, you know, concise sentences and ability to get to the point.
There is that element of honesty. I mean, often when you read a Vonnegut book, and Slaughterhouse-Five is but one example of this, it is, there's a famous, and I cannot pull up who said it, that you opened a book expecting to discover an author and instead discovered a friend.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That there is this quality there that you're not reading. It's not a passive experience. It's you are having a conversation.
Yes. And we have seen this with our visitors to the Vonnegut Library who say, Kurt Vonnegut saved my life. I've heard that many, many times. And it is because readers feel like he is their friend. And he was. If people called him, he would call them back. I don't know a lot of people who would, you know, who would make the time to do that, but he did. I know Mark has talked about that before, how Kurt would be interacting with a fan, helping somebody write an essay or something. And I, you know, that's really special.
What was it about him that made him so receptive, you think, to those strangers reaching out to him?
He was so approachable. I think being a Hoosier had something to do with that. I really do. He treated, from what I understand, I did not know him like you did, John, mm-hmm. but from what I understand, he treated everybody the same, whether you were the head of a company or the administrative assistant. He was treating everyone with, you know, value and compassion.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five, which is marking its 50th year of publication this year. It was published on March 31st, 1969. For the first time. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. I'm talking with Julia Whitehead, who is the Grand Poobah at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. We hope to be joined by Douglas Brinkley and Mark Vonnegut when we get back. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
This is Mark Vonnegut, and I've been cut off a few times, but I'm happy to be talking to you.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking in the special No Limits about the book Slaughterhouse-Five, which is marking its 50th year of publication. It was published on March 31st, 1969. For the first time, we have been talking with Julia Whitehead, who is the president and CEO, founder of the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. We are joined now by Kurt Vonnegut's son, Dr. Mark Vonnegut. Mark, how are you? And thank you for your patience in dealing with us as we try to work through some problems with the phone lines.
Thank you. I'm well, thank you.
So talk to me about, you know, I've asked Julia the question about why Slaughterhouse-Five was the breakthrough book for Kurt. You probably witnessed that from a much closer perspective than just about anyone else. Why do you think it exploded in the way it did?
I think it's a unique book that that resonated, especially with how many civilians we were killing in Vietnam. And I think it it struck a nerve for everybody with every form of PTSD. How the character became disoriented and unstuck in time. So I can't think of another book that is, you know, really like that, which is written in that way. And I think he came at it from a unique point of view because he himself had PTSD, mm-hmm. and he was writing and trying to tell the truth about what had happened to him. And I think that's where a lot of great art comes from, of people with various forms of depression, anxiety, PTSD, and they tell the truth because that's the only way they can save their own lives. So there's an immediacy to this book, which I think resonated.
And one of the things that, and Julia somewhat alluded to this, that he had been working with this material for a long time. One of the books that posthumous works that you did the foreword for, Armageddon in Retrospect, has some of his earliest attempts to deal with what happened to him over in Dresden. Why do you think it took as long as it did for him to find the approach he wanted to use with Slaughterhouse Five?
Because it's extremely complicated. I mean, he didn't set out, with an outline to write a book like other books. Mm-hmm. The thing that's impressive to me is how hard he worked to become a writer. Mm-hmm. And I think he worked so hard to become a writer because he wanted to write this book. And the other books, you know, turn out to be important too, but they're really, they're pre-Slaughterhouse-Five and post-Slaughterhouse-Five.
What's the difference between the books, would you say? Between the ones that are pre and post?
For one thing, he was working really hard as a writer because he was not a known commodity, and he was having a difficult time making a living, but he was working on the craft. And I think the earlier books, in a lot of ways, are sort of, and he would say so too, that they were better written. When he graded his own work, he was giving, he gave Sirens of Titan an A, and then his assessment of his work afterwards was that it wasn't as good. And he said that part of the problem was nobody wanted to edit him. Nobody wanted to cut a single word that Kurt Vonnegut had written, and he found that frustrating. And I think he liked the community involved in producing and making books better. Not that they're not good books.
And Julia, with the library, does Slaughterhouse attract most of the attention when people come in? Is that the book that pulls people in for the most part?
For the most part, yes. But everybody has their favorite. And even though, I think a lot of Vonnegut fans feel like if you're going to read only one Vonnegut book, it should be Slaughterhouse because it has so much of his own personal experience included there. But it's not always everyone's favorite. Mm-hmm. And so that's fun, too. If I could add one thing to what Mark said, about the, you know, the time that it took to finalize that book. We have a rejection letter where a magazine said, "I'm sorry, but your account of the firebombing of Dresden was a little too heavy-handed for our publication." And we don't know what that article looked like, and we wish we did, so that, you know, he was trying to get that story formed, along the way, but then, went through, and then he went back to Dresden, and, you know, it took him a long time to get it where he wanted it. Nine different endings, I believe, is what I heard for that, yeah.
Mark, what was his reaction when the book finally came out? Did he know when he was writing it was going to change the, you know,
yes,
the way
he?
Okay, he did. He knew it was going to change the way he was going to live his life.
Yeah, and he felt it, you know, the recognition was long overdue, and finally, you know, in terms of as a writer, he was not humble, and you know, who cares? But he, you know, he finally thought that he was getting his due, and he was finally in a category. I think he would say, you know, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and stuff like that. And I think he's right. But there was no humility. Oh, look what's happening to me. He was more like a finally.
Mm-hmm. Was he ambivalent about, because, and I should say, you and I have talked before for a magazine piece on this. Was he ambivalent about, you know, the impact, though? You know, obviously, I think one would think he would have appreciated finally getting the respect that he thought he deserved all along. But, you know, as we've talked before, there were some things that came along with that respect, celebrity and all of that, that weren't among the most comfortable things, I would guess, for him to deal with.
No, and you know, fame is a horrible thing to do to somebody, and he would, but he would say, a writer can't be a successful writer without being famous. He said it just comes with the territory. If you're going to sell that many books to make a living, you automatically. But I think his fame was above and beyond that. But he was, and the family was incredibly ambivalent about what a pain in the ass it was to have your father recognized on the street.
What ways did it impact your life? I mean, to have that.
The money was sort of striking. I had been, you know, the son of a starving artist for most of my life, and all of a sudden, you know, my family was taking, you know, was taking flights to Europe and better cars and all this stuff. And my attitude was, where did all these rich people come from? And they were my relatives.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the novel Slaughterhouse-Five, which is marking its 50th year in publication. It was first published on March 31st, 1969. If you want to join the conversation, you can test our phone lines and give us a call at 866-476-3881. The more reliable way might be to email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, you know, we've talked about the fact that was Kurt at all, Mark, I'm going to ask you this, was Kurt at all ambivalent about the fact that Slaughterhouse came to overshadow a lot of his work? And you're right, there were serious books before Slaughterhouse came alive. You know, you mentioned Sirens of Titan, Mother Night a serious, you know, would grace just about any other writer's body of work and would be considered a masterwork.
Right.
You know, was he ambivalent that seemed to push all of the other things into the background?
I think his favorite was actually Sirens of Titan, and He said he never reread his stuff, but if he had to reread one of his own novels to save a child's life, it would be Sirens of Titan. But I think he, you know, the success was, it was kind of global. I mean, one of the things that happened with Sirens of, with Slaughterhouse-Five is all the other books came back into print. Some of them had been like paperback originals, and which just, you know, didn't sell at all well. But one of the things that Slaughterhouse-Five did and continues to do is all of his books are still in print. And that's a lot of books.
And that's rare. In that, and we talked about the fact that, you know, he felt like he didn't get the respect that some of his contemporaries did. You know, John Updike or Norman Mailer or William Styron. And now, if their books technically are still in print, you can go into a lot of bookstores right now and find maybe, if you know, if you're lucky, one of Updike's novels at your local bookstore, maybe one of Mailer's or Styron's, but there is a whole row of Vonnegut. Right. Do you think he would take satisfaction out of the fact that he seems to have outlasted those guys?
I think he would. And it's the originality of you know, I love Updike, but his books are pretty classic books. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Mailer. I mean, there's some interesting first-person stuff, but it's not... the thing about my father is he was not an English major. He mm-hmm. was a chemistry major. He flunked out, but minor point. and he wrote, and again, I think the sincerity comes from his own PTSD, but things had to be right for him, and it wasn't necessarily like a classic novel. He read all the Russian novels and all that stuff, so he was always looking, but I think he was looking more for style, and I don't think he ever imitated anybody.
Julia, I want to ask you, because you did not know Kurt, you know, obviously. What was it about him, his work, and that prompted you to want to found a museum and library in his honor?
Thank you for that question. It was, you know, it was his life story that compelled me more than anything, although I believed that if we had a place for people to come, the conversations would happen about how he, you know, impacted their lives. But for me, it was, you know, here's somebody who has gone through these really traumatic experiences, not just any old trauma, like mm-hmm. His mother's suicide, you mm-hmm. know, the war experience itself, and, you know, these things. And he still had humor, and people enjoyed his company very much. And you know, how do you do that? How do you do that in after going through, you know, these horrific things? So, and then the Hoosier part mattered to me as well. What was it about being here in Indiana that that made some difference? Because he said it did in multiple places mm-hmm. or at times. He talked about how growing up here with extended family, being around, you know, being able to spend that time, that mattered, and a great public school that, you know, gave him a great education. So it's, you know, all of these different things combined to make me think that he was special beyond his work as a writer, you know, an essayist and a, you know, humorist and all of these things. He matters. And we see this now with all of these different, you know, publications talking about the 50th anniversary of the book. Mm-hmm. People know that he matters. I'm so glad to see this. It, you know, kind of validates what we all at the Vonnegut Library have thought all these years about his, you know, his longevity as an important American thinker.
Mark, when the book came out, we talked about how he, you know, he finally felt like his work was getting the respect and kind of the validation that it deserved. But given that it was written from a place of trauma, where he was trying to deal with the horrors that he had seen in Dresden, with the firebombing of that city and having to dispose of corpses and all sorts of really, really horrific things. Did the publication have a therapeutic value for him at all? Was there any sense of release?
I think all writing is therapeutic. What he said about painting or music or art is that the primary beneficiary is the artist and the writer. Mm-hmm. But I don't think having it, you know, I think it was about the writing. I think that's what made him finally feel relief. I do want to just sort of mention about the library, that the library is there because I told Julia she had to do it. I'm half joking, but when I was there after my father's death, people were talking about what to do. I said, if you guys don't start a library here, somebody will do it on the Cape or New York City, and this is where it should be. So it's my fault that Julia did
it. I'm eternally grateful to you, Mark.
Well, and Mark, why? I think I know the answer, but you always ask the question anyway. Why do you think it was so important that it be in Indianapolis rather than the Cape or New York?
the vindication or whatever that he wanted, because he had always felt, rejected, even by his own relatives, who were against his language or this or that. And when he went out there for a book signing, he had five people show up, three of them were relatives. I mean, he felt rejected by Indianapolis. And he loved Indianapolis. So I think it was important to me that it be in Indianapolis.
And is it important to the rest of your family as well, or do they care as much?
I think Nanny cares a fair amount. I think people are glad it's there, mm-hmm. But I think it matters a different amount to different people. But that's okay. That's fine.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about a milestone in Indiana history and American history, particularly the history of American literature, and that is the 50th anniversary of the publication of the classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five by Indiana's own Kurt Vonnegut. The book was published on March 31st, 1969. We are talking with Mark Vonnegut, who is medical doctor and Kurt Vonnegut's son, about the book, and Julia Whitehead, who is the president, CEO, founder of the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. We're having some trouble with our phone lines today, so you're not able to call in. But if you want to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the 50th anniversary of the publication of the classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five, which was written by Indiana's own Kurt Vonnegut. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI. We can't take phone calls today. We're struggling with the phone lines. But we hope you're enjoying the conversation. We're talking with Dr. Mark Vonnegut, Kurt Vonnegut's son, and Julia Whitehead, who is the leader of the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. So, Mark, I'm going to ask a question that, I'm just curious about. I remember talking with Sidney Offutt once, who is, as you know, one of Kurt's closest friends. And but Sidney also knew an awful lot of other writers, and he made this observation. He said, you know, one of the things that kind of separated Kurt from the others is other writers had readers, they had fans. Kurt had worshipers. I mean, he had people who almost elevated him to being a kind of oracle. And at one level, it probably was pretty cool to have that kind of influence over people. On the other hand, it also might make you feel a little uneasy. How did Kurt react to that? And how, you know, I'd also think it would be a little difficult to be the child of an oracle as well.
It had its moments.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, I think I'm as lucky as that I was out of the house before Slaughterhouse-Five was published. So in a lot of ways, my sisters had the experience of going to school as the, you know, daughters of a famous man. I think on some level he liked it, but on another, it was sort of difficult to be everybody's favorite uncle. I think he went back and forth. I think he felt compelled. Sometimes I said that if he hadn't made it as a novel, he could work for Hallmark Cards because his, you know, he put his thoughts so succinctly that they could be greeting cards. He didn't think that was very funny.
Was he able to laugh at other people's jokes? I mean, because he, at least when I was around him, he, you know, he had a great sense of humor, and his own jokes would crack him up. And I've got to admit, I wasn't secure enough to try to crack jokes with him. So,
well, it was one of the things, you know, I think we said in the myself and my sisters would say, well, the man pitches a lot better than he catches. but there were people like his brother Bernie, and they would tell each other the same jokes over and over, and Kurt with his emphysema and stuff would it could get scary, his coughing and laughing all at the same time. But he appreciated jokes and stuff, but if he was part of the joke, that'd be. He was not a great appreciator of jokes that included him.
Julia, I'm going to ask the same question based on that Sidney Offutt observation. As someone who discovered Kurt as a reader rather than, you know, through personal acquaintance, why is it, do you think it's true that Sidney's observation that other writers have fans or readers. Kurt had worshipers. I mean, people who kind of elevated him to that kind of status. And if it is true, why that was?
And, you know, I wish I had known him so that I could, you know if my thoughts about this are true or not. But I imagine him as being partly a regular guy. Mm-hmm. And then also somebody who could go hang out with high society and jet set around the world, you know, whatever. But the regular guy part of him is relatable. And, you know, I remember Nanny and Edie, his daughters, telling me in the beginning, I said, well, what kinds of stuff can we have in the museum that are, you know, reminding you of him? And they said, well, have some old sneakers and some peanut brittle. And I just love that. And, you know, when they showed up, Edie showed up and Mark and, you know, folks showed up for the first time more than 10 years ago, or I guess it was right around 10 years ago. And, you know, they bring a suitcase that has a bunch of his stuff in it. And these are priceless artifacts, but it's dad's stuff, you know, and it's I like the regular guy part of him. He was more than an author. He was a different kind of person. He was a lover of music and a humor and, you know, plays and these different things. And just that, I mean, I guess that you could relate to him.
We've gotten, go ahead. Go ahead, Mark.
I mean, he was, in terms of reading and in terms of thinking and ideas, he was an ideal gateway drug because of his, I mean, he was so self-conscious about wanting to be readable that I honestly think the reason that he was elevated to that status is that a lot of people who didn't read anything else could read him. And so that made him, you know, I don't think they would have or could have read Updike or Fitzgerald or whatever. It was just too complex. And he, you know, was very, very immediate. And so people said, wow. So they were really like getting hit by writing for the first time.
We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named Don. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Don did and reach out to us via Facebook at nolimitswfyi. He writes, in June 1968, I became the local Dell publishing rep here in Indianapolis. I would like to thank the Vonnegut family for helping me feed my kids through all these years. Well, that's got to feel a little bit good to hear, Mark.
Yes. Yeah. No, and, you know, it's you know, I love being a pediatrician, but I also, like, if you know, if it doesn't work out, we have Slaughterhouse-Five.
So, Mark, I'm going to ask this because, you know, when I talked with you earlier, you said you know, it's difficult for you to look at Slaughterhouse-Five the same way that other people do. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, the ways that it altered not just Kurt's life, but the lives of all of you around him?
I mean, part of it is for a lot of people, it seemed to come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And for myself, it was, you know, it was sort of the culmination of a very, very, very long process. And I was already a fan of a lot of the other books. Mm-hmm. And so when I looked at it and read about it, I thought, this is pretty good, but it's no Sirens of Titan. Mm-hmm. So it was, and it did, all hell broke loose in terms of the family, financially, and it was the beginning of the breakup of my parents' marriage. So it was a mixed blessing. I mean, I was really, really glad for him because I had spent, we would virtually go into, my mother and I would go into bookstores and order, you know, Sirens of Titan or whatever, would they get it? And we never picked them up, knowing that once they got the book, they'd either sell it or, you know. So it was sort of romantic to be the son of an unrecognized, very good writer.
What, Sirens of Titan, is it your favorite of your father's books?
Yeah.
Where would Slaughterhouse-Five fall in your personal rankings?
Oh, let me go. It would be roughly number three.
Number three? What's number two then?
God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater.
Okay. Okay, and what elevates those two above Slaughterhouse?
I think, you know, the portrayal of money and its importance in our culture. And, you know, money is right up there with war. Mm-hmm. And Sirens of Titan was just sort of this incredible, long perspective on Earth and Earth history and all these things, where humans thought they were, you know, like building the Wall of China, and it was just like the comma and a message from outer space. So I love the one, Sirens of Titan, sort of putting humans and human history in perspective, and I loved Rosewater for just sort of its savage portrayal of how important money was to us.
Julia, is Slaughterhouse your favorite, or are there other Vonnegut books that...
Well, like I said earlier, sometimes I'll tell people, if you're only going to read one, read Slaughterhouse. But God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater was the one that I read when I came up with the idea to start the Vonnegut Museum and Library. And you know, what Mark said about the book, you know, I feel the same way. The other part is just the kindness of, you know, the main character of that book. And again, he's a guy that, you know, he's not a perfect guy. He's kind of a slob sometimes and, you know, other things. But he is so kind and generous with what he is able to do and with his time and resources. And there's humor. There's a great ending to that book, which I love, the way that book ends. And it's what I think of when I think of Kurt Vonnegut, the social justice part. I also love Mother Night because I just think it's a great story. Vonnegut often will have that quote that, you know, in Mother Night it is, "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful what we pretend to be." Slaughterhouse 5, it's "So It Goes," and you know, we've talked before about what all that means. But you know, every one of his books has something, a takeaway, that takeaway quote or thought or concept that you are applying to your own life. I think that's why people relate to him too, that he takes topics that matter to everybody, whether it's you know, your kids or your school or your you know, relationships or whatever, and we can all relate to what he's talking about, even if it's something that is science fiction at times. There's just this relatability in that he gets it. He is the voice of reason, and he is, you know, and we can relate to what he is hoping for, to, you know, for this planet to be a better place, for us to treat each other better.
So, Mark, you know, 50 years is a milestone. Most books, frankly, are out of print 2 or 3 years after they have been published. And we know not only is it still in print, but this year at least, we know at least 86,000 copies. The publisher is going to move at least 86,000 of those. You know, with that, how did you and your family approach it? Was it something that that made any kind of difference? Were you excited, or do you think, oh God, you know, once again we've got to deal with this?
We you know, we were aware that it was coming, and you know, saw it as an opportunity to sort of refresh the public memory, I guess that's about it. And we wanted to make sure that the trust and everything was in good shape, and it sort of gave us a motive to get, we wanted everything to be clean and beautiful by the time the 50th anniversary comes around.
And Julia, again, we ought to talk about how the museum, because we're getting close on time here, we've got just a couple of minutes left, how the museum and library are commemorating the occasion.
Yeah, and I'll just start with the building, because that's the most important thing for us right now. By May 15th, we need to raise $1 million. We are sitting just under $200,000 of that goal right now. And that sets into motion other giving that or potential giving that, you know, is so important. The thing about that building, it is not just a museum. Bluebeard, the restaurant Bluebeard, we're in very serious conversations with having them move a cafe onto that first floor. It's going to be a hangout for musical performances, author talks, poetry readings, partnering with the Madam Walker Legacy Center. It's a place for students across the street on the campus of IUPUI and others, people who live there, to come and enjoy culture in, you know, not, this is not just Vonnegut culture. This is you know, lots of writers and musicians and humorists and others. We want to be that community venue for people to just come and hang out. Because he, you know, he said, you know, he fighting that terrible disease of loneliness is, you know, a stable community. We need a stable community. And that's, we see ourselves as that. We're not just a museum. We're not just a library. In fact, the library is really a very small part of what, you know, our building had been and what our new building will be. But it's just a wonderful plan for that section of Indiana Avenue. And then we have the book giveaway, 86,000 books. Go to VonnegutLibrary.org to support the building, to support our programs. And, of course, Night of Vonnegut, April 11th. We still have some tickets, not many, to hear Salman Rushdie talk about his friendship with Kurt Vonnegut and aspects of the book and free speech. And so, yeah, there are lots of things going on. We would love to have people join in any ways they can, including volunteerism.
Mark, I am going to give you the last word here because we're just about, you'll have about 30 seconds to do it. How should people who loved your father and his work mark this occasion?
Maybe prayer and meditation on peace.
I did not know him obviously nearly as well as you did, but that sounds like something he would say. So I would like to thank you both very much for dealing with the phone lines, Mark, in your case, and Julia for hanging in there with us for what I think was ended up being a very insightful conversation about an important man and an important book. And I'd also like to thank our audience, as usual, for joining us. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.